What's up, everyone? I'm Andrew Steinwald, and this is Zima Red. On this show, we speak with the users, founders, and creatives that are diving into the world of unique digital assets, also called non-fungible tokens. My guest today is Alex Larson, a senior associate at the $300 million venture fund, Blockchain Capital. Blockchain Capital is one of the oldest, most reputable, and largest venture funds in the crypto space. It was a blast getting to speak with Alex. Thoughtful, eloquent, and insatiably curious, Alex and I touch upon all parts of the NFT ecosystem. I peppered him with questions ranging from his thoughts on the metaverse, the ethos of crypto, and what advice he would give a team pitching Blockchain Capital. Anyone who is looking to form a startup and raise venture capital, I highly suggest you listen to this insightful conversation. Please enjoy my conversation with Alex. Alex, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really excited to chat with you. And to get us started, I'd love to hear a little bit about your background.
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up moving back and forth quite a bit between the States and Denmark. My mom's side of the family is from Denmark, so I spent a lot of time in both countries. You know, growing up, I was always interested in math and physics. So for university, I went to study systems engineering and computer science at WashU in St. Louis. Systems engineering is really applied math and physics. So it's focused on system level optimizations and combining lots of different pieces. But it really has a broad set of applications from things like air traffic control to financial engineering. And I was always drawn more to the financial engineering side of things. And so I was originally recruiting from quant groups at large banks, but was ultimately pretty uninspired by being in the back office of a bank. But I still wanted to learn about capital markets and finance. And so I went into a more generalist role in investment banking at Guggenheim, where I helped structure and manage IPOs, private equity placements, and mergers and acquisitions. Early into that job in 2016, I stumbled on CoinMarketCap. I think it was Fred Wilson's AVC blog that originally turned me onto it, and I was immediately intrigued. I had some friends who had played around with Bitcoin in college and even some that had built Bitcoin ATMs, but I didn't know there were markets for other coins too at the time. And I was used to looking at public stocks, so the volatility on these things on a daily basis stuck out immediately. The first thing I wanted to do was trade them. I had pretty strict compliance around what stocks I could trade, but crypto was fair game, so I started paying attention really on nights and weekends. And then ICOs started happening in kind of 2016, early 2017. And that was when I realized this technology could be used to solve problems across the financial services industry, including potentially the types of capital formation events that I was working on. I knew I wasn't going to stay at a bank for very long, and from that point on, I wanted to be in the crypto space. So capital raising, I think, is a really relationship-intensive process, and investment bankers market offerings to investors they know, and there's quite a bit of trust involved in terms of who gets a look. Only certain types of opportunities end up fitting the mold of that process, and only certain investors get access to it. And I think these filters are necessary to have an efficient process in the current system, but they exclude huge amounts of the potential market. And so ICOs were way on the other side of that spectrum, with open access, you know, no regulation, no gatekeeper, but a process bound by trust and shared rules executed on an unbiased, decentralized blockchain network. So, you know, obviously there are a ton of problems with that, as we saw. But if you're trying to pick which avenue has more potential for building global capital markets 20 years from now, I thought that ICOs were a more interesting foundation to build from and offered a glimpse into the role that blockchains could play in facilitating financial services and capital markets more broadly. And so I started going to meetups in New York, sending work that I had done, investment kind of valuation models and so on, and just research pieces. Basically just to get feedback to people and offered to work for them for free in order to get up to speed. And I ended up finding Spencer Bogard, who's a partner at Blockchain Capital. I found his email address on the Blockchain Capital newsletter at some point, and I sent him a bunch of work and asked him for a phone call. And we got on the phone. They happened to be looking to expand the team at the time, and it turned out to be a really good fit. So I joined them about 2 years ago on the investment team.
That's amazing. So it's really cool to see that you were in traditional finance and definitely kind of focused on raising capital in the traditional way. And then you discovered crypto in 2016 due to the volatility, and then especially due to the ICOs, which showed the ease of raising capital from participants from anywhere in the world. And as you pointed out, rightly, that there are a ton of pros and cons to being able to quickly raise capital from anyone and anywhere in the world. There's a lot of issues with that, obviously. But at the same time, you point out that it also opens up the doors and possibilities to all sort of different methods to raise capital that kind of break down the barriers for regular people, which is hugely important. So were you attracted to crypto at all from a standpoint of, you know, like underlying values of kind of like, okay, you know, the Fed is printing money and kind of down with the banks. Did that appeal to you at all? Or was it more of the fundraising side of things?
Yeah, no, I that definitely appealed to me. And I think is probably what ultimately, you know, drew me into the space. I think initially the revolutionary spirit of Bitcoin resonated pretty strongly with me. I've never really been someone who is particularly good at following rules. So I think I was predisposed to being interested in crypto. Nick Carter actually wrote a brilliant distillation of Bitcoin's spirit. I think it's called A Most Peaceful Revolution, that captures that revolutionary aspect of Bitcoin really well, I think. And in the piece, he points out that you know, where libertarians tried to go through the democratic process to affect the change that they wanted, Bitcoiners instead just kicked over the chessboard and created the world that they wanted to live in. And they did so in a way that appears to be unstoppable. So I think that Bitcoin gave good values and good ideas a path to prominence that routes around incumbent power structures who may really be opposed to any ideas, whether they're good or bad, that undermine basically their power. And if you think about kind of the right to bear arms in its original intention as a means of maintaining an ultimate check on government, in a way, decentralized networks offer a modern approach to that same thing. And so I think this resonated with me because the values that crypto networks like Bitcoin embody and propagate, transparency, inclusiveness, democratized access, meritocracy, privacy, those are values that I think are really beneficial to the world and also severely lacking today. And by embedding these values in unstoppable technologies, I think crypto offers a path forward that could end up having a world-changing impact down the line, if it hasn't already. And when you think about the kind of potential trajectory of crypto networks and the kind of impact that they might be able to have in the world, a lot of other ideas become comparatively less interesting, in my opinion. And maybe this is why the crypto rabbit hole functions almost as a bit of a one-way valve that just sucks people in and very few people end up, you know, leaving and going back to do other things.
All right, so what are your personal views on cryptocurrencies in general, like, you know, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and the other altcoins?
Bitcoin, I think, is in a class of its own. It's a non-sovereign store of value. It's the first viable non-sovereign store of value in the history of humankind. It's also the most secure blockchain. It has a great brand and I think a pretty simple value prop. But maybe most importantly, its simplicity, its consistency, and its resilience really make it very socially scalable, to quote Nick Szabo. So I expect that it will continue to have the largest network by far. And is still pretty early in its trajectory of growth around the world. Ethereum is the second and potentially only other truly decentralized blockchain network at this stage, I think. To me, it's kind of the blockchain equivalent of move fast and break things, the Silicon Valley ethos. And I think a lot of the ideas that Ethereum has enabled will be game changers. If they're not, you know, in their version one now, then down the line at some point. But I think it's important to push the boundaries and see how much this technology is capable of. And in addition, I think tokens are a pretty brilliant innovation. So I'm very constructive on both Bitcoin and Ethereum. And think they both have really interesting communities and quite a bit of developer momentum on both sides. In terms of altcoins, I would say probably the category that I'm most excited about is stablecoins. They're really an amazing use case for tokens. They address a lot of the complaints of crypto-based payment systems. They're more useful, I think, than traditional payment rails too. They offer faster settlement, better assurances around transactions in a lot of cases. And they have this growing network and ability to leverage what really was kind of the large scale infrastructure build out that Ethereum and Bitcoin's rise have catalyzed over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years. So we see a lot of increased activity even with companies fundraising in USDC. We've actually invested in a couple of projects now using stablecoins, as well as, you know, increased activity with crypto businesses invoicing in stablecoins. So I think that to me seems like the most likely next area of traction, apart from those first two networks. So is probably the category of altcoins that I'm most constructive on right now.
That's so cool. I had no idea that there were startups now that were raising USDC and using USDC for invoices and stuff like that. That's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not commonplace yet, but it's starting to happen a little bit. And I think there are a lot of benefits. And, you know, the more people are doing that, the easier it becomes to do that. And then all of a sudden, you can pay your employees in it. You can pay for all your contracts in it. And the network effect just kind of grows from there.
So going off of that again, so what are you more personally excited about? The kind of the use case of the non-sovereign store of value, like Bitcoin use case, or the kind of more Ethereum smart contract platform use case of like programmable decentralized applications?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I think I was probably first drawn to kind of the creativity in Ethereum, but over time, it's. I think you spend, the more time you kind of spend in the space, the more respect you end up having for Bitcoin and the position that it's carved out for itself, and also, you know, the consistency that it really has in terms of the values that it propagates to the world. So I think that what Bitcoin is today is more close to what it's going to be in the future than what Ethereum is today to what that's going to look like down the line. So I don't know that I'd like to make a choice. I like both of them for very different reasons, and I'm bullish on both of them also for different reasons. And ultimately, I think that they're complementary technologies. It wouldn't be good to run the types of experiments that we run on Ethereum on Bitcoin. I think that there's too much at stake, and Ethereum, in a way, needs Bitcoin to continue to grow. Bitcoin is, I guess, the sort of like index or reserve currency for the entire space. And it's hard to see Bitcoin going to zero and that not, you know, very materially negatively impacting just about every other project in the space. So I think that they're additive, and I like both of them a lot for different reasons.
I like that. A very diplomatic, but truthful response, how they're both very complementary to each other. So what are your general views on non-fungible tokens? I'm not sure if you've dived too deeply into NFTs or not, but or especially your firm, I'm not really sure. But what are your personal views on NFTs?
Yeah, we've done a little bit in NFTs. You know, I think, I guess at the highest level, most things are not fungible. If you hang out in the crypto space too long, I think you might be fooled into thinking otherwise, but fungibility is a scarce property itself. And we could debate the extent to which even Bitcoins are fungible at this point. I think NFTs are super exciting because they represent non-currency digital assets. I think there are some really interesting benefits of putting all types of assets on blockchains. You could have a lot of financial agreements that might be best represented as NFTs, video game assets that are unique and interoperable across different game ecosystems. Digital art is a really interesting category, and really collectibles of all sorts. People, I think, if you look historically, have an innate desire to collect things. If you go through your house, I'm sure there's bound to be hundreds, if not thousands, of things that you've collected and value for some reason that you wouldn't want to give up. And I think that desire to own something seems to be amplified when things are scarce, and also when other people want them. And those are things that I think will be as true in the digital realm as they are in the physical realm. And the digital realm, in my view, is going to be many times larger than the physical realm. So this is more or less kind of a certainty in my mind. People already spend a significant amount of time on screens, and virtual spaces are only really getting started with things like Fortnite. So I think NFTs have been slow to grow because they're not solving a lot of today's problems. They're solutions to, you know, I guess, property rights, counterfeiting in a virtual world. And I think they're the right solution, but the virtual world needs time to mature. maybe really interesting NFTs end up pulling people into digital worlds. I've seen some fascinating activity along that front with people creating art galleries and crypto voxels, but it's still just hackers and really early enthusiasts. So, you know, I guess to sum that up, I really like the themes behind NFTs. I think they have massive potential, and I also think it's going to take a pretty long time, and it'll probably grow with emerging virtual worlds. I'd be curious for your opinion here too, as you obviously spend a lot of time in the NFT space. Where do you think that NFTs add the most value?
That's a really interesting question about where they add the most value. I think I'm most excited about the use case of NFTs being used for ownership of virtual land, and I guess virtual land platforms as a whole, because I see virtual land as kind of a next generation platforms in a sense. If you go on Facebook, you know, you can make a social media profile, and that's well and fun and all good. But if you buy a piece of land in a virtual world, you can create your social media profile on there, or you can create a little e-commerce store and sell digital art or digital clothing, or you can create a mini game. Like, it's basically like you're almost buying a web space in a limited area on the internet. So, you know, there's 10,000 plots of land, and each one of those 10,000 plots are essentially like a little website. Because they're on this virtual city or town, it's also kind of like a social network. So you're combining all of these different use cases onto a scarce like web platform, scarce web platform that the users actually own. And I think that like the ability for the users to do and build whatever they want, that's super powerful. The fact that they have skin in the game, that's extremely powerful. The fact that it's a social network, that's extremely powerful. You know, it's like there's all these maximum like powerful effects happening within this one area of the web. And that to me, it's just is like, that's why I'm like so excited for a virtual worlds that utilize NFTs. I think that virtual worlds that don't utilize NFTs, you're losing out on a ton of those really powerful benefits.
Yeah, no, that's I think that's really fascinating. What do you think makes, I guess, virtual land desirable? Is it that other people are there? Is it that businesses are built there? I mean, when you're starting a new kind of like virtual world, I guess you start from zero and nothing's going on. So while the real estate assets in there or the property assets are scarce to begin with, are they inherently valuable just on the basis of being scarcity, or does the value come from kind of the activity and the network effect of other people showing up there and doing other things there?
Yeah, I think it absolutely comes from the value of other people showing up and starting to build stuff. And the very first people, you know, in crypto voxels, for example, the very first parcels of land were selling for like, you know, I don't know, like 0.1 Ethereum or something like that, like something extremely cheap. And now the parcels go for, you know, anywhere from 3 to 6 Ethereum or something like that. And those people that were first purchasing the land at the very, very beginning, I think it was in June of 2018, they were taking a big chance. You know, they found out about it somehow, and they said, hey, I want to buy a piece of land and build something cool on this. And, you know, I can kind of see the vision long term. And you know, slowly but surely, people started coming there, populate the world, and build on it. And one really interesting thing about CryptoVoxels that I found is that the people that populated the world or started to populate the world were mostly artists, like crypto artists. And these crypto artists, they want to showcase their work in some sort of manner, because right now we can showcase our NFTs on OpenSea, but it's really more exciting when you're kind of immersed in this like 3D type environment. And so you had artists coming to this neighborhood and gentrifying it. You know, they would come in, they would build something beautiful, and they would gentrify this virtual world. And I wrote a blog post about how I thought it was so cool that artists are just like, they're like the most, I don't know, they just like go for it. You know, they're like, hey, let's just try it out. They're like the early adopters on like in like the physical world with real neighborhoods and also the virtual. So I thought that was a really cool kind of analogy that I looked at.
That's a hilarious concept of gentrifying kind of like a virtual neighborhood. I actually would be curious, do you know, so parcels in CryptoVoxels have different values based on where they're located. Are the ones that are closer to kind of the artist neighborhoods, have those risen in value relative to less developed areas of CryptoVoxels?
Yeah, so the value of the parcels is based off of a couple different factors, like its height, volume of the parcel, the distance from the center, because anyone can access CryptoVoxels through the browser just by clicking, hey, enter world, and you get transported right into the center of the world. And so anywhere that's close to the center, that's valuable. There's a neighborhood called Frankfurt. It has the tallest parcels, and that's like the financial district. But there was one user named Conlon, who's now the founder of Async Art, which is a crypto art platform. Really cool. He bought up a ton of Gangnam, like parcels in a neighborhood called Gangnam, the Korean town, a Korean city. It's Gangnam. I'm not good at pronouncing it. So he bought a ton of parcels there, and he built it up really, really, really beautifully, like incredibly awesome, like really detailed. And that rose all the land values within that area significantly. So now if anyone wants a parcel within that neighborhood, it's really difficult to get, and they're selling for really high prices. So what I found super interesting was that you could increase the value of your land by building beautiful things on it. It's almost like you're, from an investing standpoint, it's like it's an activist investment in the sense of you don't just purchase the land and sit on it. If you want to actually raise the value of it, you go in there and you build something beautiful and spend some hours doing it, and then it'll increase the land. So to answer your question, there's a ton of different factors, but it's dependent on where you are and volume and height and whatnot.
Oh, that's fascinating. I actually didn't know that. I'll have to check it out later. Yeah, I came, I think, to the Crypto Voxels game a little bit later, and I ended up being someone who paid like 2 ETH for my little plot of land, but I like it and I'm happy with it.
That's not that bad. I feel like 2 ETH is pretty good for nowadays. Was it in Origin City, the main area?
I'm not sure where it is, to be honest.
I feel like Crypto Voxels and a lot of these other Ethereum-based virtual worlds, they're kind of the very inklings of a true metaverse beginning to form. And you know, you did mention earlier that you have a belief that digital realms might become larger than the physical. I want to know like what your general views are on the metaverse.
Yeah, so I first read about the metaverse in Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash, and I think that's probably pretty common. That's the first description of a metaverse that I'm aware of. So I think the metaverse in some form is inevitable given our current trajectory on the internet and our increasing emergence into virtual spaces. It's probably useful to specify what I think of as the metaverse, since I'd imagine that you get a pretty different answer depending on who you ask. But you know, I guess I subscribe to some version of the Snow Crash view of what the metaverse is. So in other words, a persistent, continuous virtual space or set of spaces where really anyone can come and go as they please, where events happen synchronously in real time. There might be games, places to hang out, concerts, many of the types of experiences that you could have physically, and then a bunch that wouldn't be possible in the real world at all because of the laws of physics. There would be a complete economy with the ability to earn, own, buy, sell, pay, create, invest, and so on. And ultimately, it would become a place that you have to have a presence, similar to what the internet has become today. Is, you know, curious, what does the metaverse mean to you? Is it kind of similar in your mind, or do you have a different view?
Yeah, I like to ask this question because it's such a broad topic that does not have a succinct answer. Like, I've never heard anyone that says that said something where I was like, oh, that's absolutely correct. It's generally just, it's whatever it means to you. There was one really good person named Avier that I interviewed for the podcast, and I said, what does the metaverse mean to you? And he said, it means life. And I thought that was really, really cool because it's basically, we are building a digital equivalent of the physical world inside this virtual environment. A lot of people today are kind of concerned that, hey, if we're spending most of our time in virtual environments, won't that be bad? But I don't necessarily think so. I think that there could be a lot of good that comes out of living inside a virtual environment. I don't really know what the ramifications of an actual metaverse are and what it means, but I know that it's coming and I know that it's exciting. And I do believe that it will be a major force for good. I can't say like how it will. I'm very positive about the future of a world where people can create whatever they would like. In the physical world, as we know, especially going on today and, you know, mid 2020, shit's crazy, right? So if we could have an area that we could construct ourselves based off of things that we love, I think that that's a really exciting prospect, kind of like an escape in a sense, but in a positive way, not in like kind of the negative connotation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's almost like asking the question of whether the internet is good or not, or like whether something like Twitter is good or not. You know, obviously both have potential for good and both have potential for harm. It's difficult to kind of assess what the net effect is. But I think there's probably an element of choice on the part of the participant in terms of curating your own experience and deciding, you know, how you'd like to use the metaverse. You know, I think like the kind of Snow Crash version of a metaverse could have in some ways a flattening effect on the world, where physical location is no longer really important. And a metaverse connection would almost be akin to an access card to the global economy. And I'm sure there would be new hierarchies within the metaverse, like kind of like the cafe in Snow Crash, where only certain people are allowed to enter. But the baseline for where you start off would no longer be dependent on where you were born, which I think is a pretty massive step in itself. I guess without a doubt, I think it'll be a great platform to build businesses. It could even become the dominant labor platform. I bet you could run a more effective organization if the constraints of the physical world no longer existed. I think it's also pretty easy to see kind of a mental shift at some point where people's lives transition from happening mostly in the physical world to happening mostly in the metaverse. And in some ways that transition has already started for a lot of, I think, gamers especially. And the next step towards the metaverse is probably to make the leap from games to work, in my opinion. And if you can turn on a gaming rig and earn a living every day, which a small group of people do today, and I think mostly streamers, but actually earn that through services or products that you sell entirely in a virtual world, that for me is really a turning point and an accelerator towards the metaverse.
You bring up a ton of really good points there. One thing I always think about in terms of the metaverse is that our society today is based off of, you know, consumption and, you know, growth at all costs, essentially. And I think that obviously leads to a few unhealthy side effects, you know, global warming, deforestation, et cetera. And I think that if we were living and working, especially inside of virtual worlds and being able to support ourselves, then obviously the need for consuming a lot of goods, physical goods, and consuming a lot of resources would diminish in theory. That could have a huge impact, a positive impact on the world as a whole. What I would fear a lot is us building a metaverse, and it's so incredible and amazing that people don't want to go out into the physical world and live and kind of go explore the stars and whatnot and go colonize other planets. That would be a detriment, because I think we need to go on both angles. We need to go deeper into the virtual, and we also need to go deeper into like our galaxy and universe. So anyways, that's kind of a tangent. But all right, so do you think that it's possible to have a metaverse without non-fungible tokens?
Maybe. Maybe some sort of a consortium model might be sufficient to make a functional metaverse. But I don't think that it would be nearly as interesting as one that has NFTs and ultimately open neutral standards that are easier to adopt than closed, biased, permissioned ones. You know, what you get with NFTs, and maybe more broadly with blockchain-based ownership, is provable neutrality and very high security for your assets. And in order for a ton of economic activity to happen in the metaverse, you'd need buy-in from a huge number of untrusting parties, many of which I think will be very hesitant to adopt a set of rules that favors one or a number of parties over everyone else. So I think it's possible that if a centralized effort gets escape velocity, that they have enough leverage that companies will have no choice but to bring their IP onto that platform. And in a way, we kind of see that with how brands are joining Fortnite now and realizing that that's an important avenue for them and channel. But for economic activity beyond marketing, and especially activity that involves valuable assets, financial agreements, corporate revenues, salaries, and so on, I think there would be great hesitation to putting that kind of trust in a single company or small group of companies, which might make it difficult for someone to create a centrally operated metaverse. It's much more likely to me that the winning metaverse sits on a set of open standards, and blockchains are currently the best solution to providing trust at scale across many untrusting parties, which I think makes NFTs a technology that's really well suited to the metaverse. Let me flip a different version of the same question back to you. NFT ideology and open neutral ecosystems run counter to the strategies of a lot of tech giants that will probably be important in building the technology that'll power the metaverse, which means that they're likely to try to do it without blockchain initially. What do you think the world looks like if the metaverse has a centralized operator?
A really, really good question. And I do believe that the first, you know, kind of metaverse-like environment that people are exposed to will be one that is either owned and operated by Google, Facebook, Epic Games, some large centralized corporation. I think that it'll be people's first exposure will be that centralized world, and it'll function fine and it'll work fine. But it's like the analogy that I like to use is like China versus the United States, for example. So business and capitalism, it operates and flourishes in China, no problem, right? In general, there's few problems, I guess, overall. You know, it's the second largest economy in the world, and there's billionaires over there and whatnot. But if you really want to be secure with your property rights, with your assets, with your business, you go build a business in America, because you know that for the most part, the government cannot arbitrarily seize your assets in America like they can in China. So I think that what we'll see is these centralized metaverses appear first, and on a really, really wide scale, you know, 50 million users, 100 million users. But there will be these blockchain-based alternatives that will be smaller. But I think that over time, they will grow. And I think people will over time be attracted to them because of their secure property rights and the just general security that goes with these decentralized versions of a metaverse. And as a user, would I rather spend more time, money, and effort in a world where my assets can get seized? Or would I rather spend that time, money, and effort in a world where I'm extremely secure in what I do? I think it's a clear answer, but it's not going to be easy. It's going to be a slog. I don't see people like rushing towards crypto voxels anytime soon, or Somnium Space, or whatever it might be. Yeah, that's kind of how I see it today.
Interesting. I think that's a great point. I mean, you know, to exactly your point, the strength of rule of law in a given jurisdiction is probably, I would guess, the most impactful explanatory variable for economic activity and growth. So I think that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, I think there'll be certain events that causes large portions of people to move over to decentralized metaverses. So it'll be, you know, some big gamer or some big streamer or some popular person or whatever, his business is seized or his assets are seized for XYZ reasons. You know, maybe he tweeted like free Hong Kong or something like that, and then his assets get taken away. There's that famous example of the online trading card game. I forget the name of it right now, but it's a centralized game. It's online. And
Hearthstone?
Yeah, exactly. Can't believe I forgot that. So Hearthstone, he tweeted free Hong Kong after he won the tournament. All of his assets got taken away. And so that's actually right when Gods Unchained was launching, which is the, you know, crypto decentralized version, or not decentralized, but, you know, their assets are NFT, so at least the users own them. And so that led to a big exodus of people leaving Hearthstone to go to Gods Unchained. So I think there'll be events like that cause these decentralized metaverses to grow in popularity.
Yeah, I think I tend to agree with that. That was a great moment for Gods Unchained.
All right, so what specific crypto niche do you like the most? And this is a personal opinion, not the opinion of your firm or anything. So is it, you know, stuff like DeFi, smart contract platforms, you know, NFTs, kind of what interests you the most?
Yeah, I spend a lot of time thinking about DeFi myself. It's where my experience in financial services and capital markets has the most overlap with crypto. And I think it's a set of applications that are very well suited for the technology, and really in particular, the current state of the technology, which works well for high value, low frequency transactions like loans or insurance contracts, but doesn't work as well for lower value, higher volume transactions. So financial services are also highly fragmented, especially across geographies, and many people and businesses around the world are underserved by them, which I think makes it a pretty interesting problem set. I'm kind of obsessed with this idea of a full-service bank like JP Morgan, but constructed modularly using open decentralized software systems. DeFi today kind of gives us a glimpse at what that might look like, but it's essentially a massive globally sourced balance sheet where you have thousands of applications and services built on top that leverage that balance sheet to offer financing, savings, custody, investment management, payment services, insurance, basically everything that the financial system offers to those that are deemed creditworthy today, and then much more that we probably haven't even thought of yet or that haven't been possible before. And with that kind of infrastructure in place, innovation in fintech, I think, would be 10 to 100 times faster, because to get off the ground, you wouldn't need partnerships with banks to offer new services. You would be able to tap into open rules-based balance sheets of DeFi protocols. And so with innovation happening really at the edges on top of a neutral shared infrastructure, you don't have a lot of the barriers to access that exist today for consumers, and markets would be global from day one. And so ultimately, I think would be able to be larger. So I think that once kind of an open software-based network of balance sheets have the resilience, the security, and really the usability that more closely resembles what you get from banks today, at that point, I would be pretty afraid if I were a bank to compete against an open source ecosystem with similar capabilities. we're obviously not close to that yet, but I think the next decade will be interesting on this front for sure.
Do you think that banks of today, do you think that they will wholly disappear, or that just their roles will be greatly diminished, or that they'll just all adopt these kind of open DeFi protocols and, you know, their fees will compress and their headcount will compress and whatnot? Like, what does the future of banking look like?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I think of DeFi mostly as being a competitor, and maybe even, well, the thing is, it's not even a competitor in the sort of traditional sense of that word. A bank could use DeFi protocols to offer new products. So there's a lot of reasons why they wouldn't do that today. But if they have an existential threat from new, you know, neobanks that are using blockchain-based protocols in order to offer better products and better access, then I think banks won't have any choice but to innovate and build out those products as well, and especially if they're seeing demand from their customers for it. So I don't think that banks are going to disappear. I don't think that they'll be completely uprooted. I think that they will reluctantly and probably too late be forced to offer some of these products. I don't think we're close to that point yet, and there are just so many challenges on the kind of security and usability front that need to be addressed before that discussion can even be had. But yeah, I mean, I think that they're going to end up probably, you know, serving different parts of the market and handholding people and maybe providing assurances around using some of those DeFi protocols, because most users aren't going to tap into a protocol by like popping open MetaMask and funding their crypto wallet and backing up their seed phrase, etc. Most are going to probably, you know, access these protocols via custodian of some sort, and you know, maybe that's Coinbase, maybe that's some of the newer custodians, or maybe it's also banks and Main Street. So I think it's probably more complementary, but it's certainly going to force them to make some changes and probably drive a lot of product development at some of those larger places. But I think there's certainly a window of opportunity for you know, new, faster moving, more agile banks, and especially those that come from the crypto space, to offer those services and to be really competitive with some of Wall Street.
All right. So what is Blockchain Capital and what do you do there?
Yeah. So Blockchain Capital is a venture capital firm dedicated to the blockchain space. It was one of the first firms founded to invest in blockchain technology back in 2013. So as a firm, we've invested through a number of market and narrative cycles. In the last 8 years, we've made about 90 investments in companies and protocols doing everything from exchange and custody to stablecoins to decentralized derivatives to NFT markets. Really anything that touches blockchain is fair game for us. And while we're technically stage agnostic, seed and Series A are where we're the most active and where I think we're able to add the most value. We're currently investing out of our fifth fund. As a firm, I think we've collectively never been more excited about the prospects for blockchain technology and blockchain-based businesses than we are today. We view ourselves really as long-term partners to blockchain projects of all shapes and sizes. So we're going to continue to work closely with our portfolio companies and hope to also partner with new exciting companies that are using blockchain to carve a new path forward. And hopefully we can help them become large businesses as well. You know, as for myself specifically, I'm a part of the investment team. So I meet with a lot of founders, help guide them through our diligence and investment process, work closely with them as well once we become investors. I also do a lot of research that helps inform the areas that we invest in. In a lot of ways, you know, Blockchain Capital is a startup itself, and so we're fairly lean and scrappy with a team of 13. So I help out on all sides of the business wherever needed, really.
That's great. So your day-to-day is not one set thing. You're kind of researching, you're hearing pitches, you're dealing with, you know, back office administrative stuff. Like, is it kind of, it's kind of a mixture of a little bit of everything, like a traditional startup?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my time is spent in meetings. It's just the nature of the business. Meetings with portfolio companies, prospective investments, various partners of ours throughout the crypto ecosystem, reference checks, diligence calls, and so on. And a lot of those used to be in person, but now with shelter in place, most are via video conference or phone call. I also tend to block off time whenever it's possible to get reading, research, and writing done. either for our investment committee or internal research for my team and our limited partners, or public pieces that maybe end up getting put on the Blockchain Capital blog and get added to our monthly newsletter. Interestingly, I thought that shelter in place would cause a large slowdown in the crypto space, but I've seen activity really pick up instead, I think fueled in part by market conditions. So I'm surprisingly as busy as I've ever been right now.
You mentioned that you kind of look at everything within the crypto space. You guys are not just focused on infrastructure or DeFi or whatever it might be. Are you guys actively looking at blockchain-based games or anything to do with NFTs?
Yeah, we certainly do. We have a couple of investments in the NFT space, and we do look at the NFT space. I think that the challenge right now with NFTs is that the market is just really early, and it's quite small at the moment. And we've seen activity in the NFT space kind of tick up in, I think, the last really 6 to 9 months, but it still has a long way to go in terms of being a market size that is kind of anywhere near what cryptocurrency markets look like from a volume perspective. I mean, just a couple of kind of like high level numbers here. I think that the monthly trading volume for NFTs right now is like $2 to $3 million. I might be off there. You might be closer to the numbers on that. But it's something like 100 million is the total amount of trading volume that has happened in NFTs so far in their history. So I think we're really in like the very first inning of NFTs, but it's a space that I think has a lot of really interesting advantages. And we absolutely do look at investments in that space and have made a number of them as well.
You're correct. The monthly is around 2 to 3 million, and the total since I believe it was June of 2017 is 97 million. We just hit 97 this morning. So that's pretty exciting. Almost 100. So when a team comes in to pitch you guys, are you guys looking at their background only, or like, is there one focus that you guys like to look at? So you'll say, hey, this team is great. I know they've done X, Y, Z in the past, but they're starting this brand new venture, let's say in the NFT space, and like we're not really sure about it. Like, is there any sort of one thing that you guys look at and say, hey, the team's great, so let's go? Or is it more of like, all right, the team has to be good, the market has to be good, the niche has to be good, like the product has to be great? Like, what is it that you guys focus on?
Yeah, I mean, it's different for every investment. We look at projects on a case-by-case basis and try to analyze them from first principles. For instance, the qualities that make for a successful centralized exchange business are different from the qualities that make for a successful decentralized protocol in a lot of cases. But I can generalize and I highlight some of the kind of important ones that matter across both. First and foremost, we look for exceptional founders, people with excellent leadership, management, and communication skills, and who have strong judgment that that we think will allow them to navigate a startup through multiple pivots if needed. And people with passion for what they're building and integrity as well. All startups have challenges ahead, and the best founders I know take a very sober and objective view of those challenges and show us how they're thinking through navigating them. At the end of the day, nothing we invest in is a sure thing, but the more we can understand about the specific problems that need to be solved, the easier it is to have faith that a founder or set of founders are well equipped for the task. From there, we look at the rest of the team, things like market size, go-to-market strategy, community building skills, business model, plan and ability to build a long-term competitive moat, traction, burn rate, financing, use of funds, and a number of other things that are a bit more specific. But a lot of these things can change, and ultimately we're investing in founders over ideas. So there's a great book by Jim Collins and Jerry Porras called Built to Last, where they coin an interesting phrase, clock builder versus time teller. A time teller can always tell you the precise time, and the analogy would be a great idea that someone comes up with. But a clock builder can build you a clock that continues to tell you the precise time even after the builder itself is gone. And so this is someone who can build a great company that's wired to produce good results, even if the idea changes over time and evolves. And I think a lot of the time we're investing in clock builders. The idea matters, certainly, but the way you think about executing on it says more about the clock that's being built and ultimately about what we're investing in.
It's a beautiful analogy. I love that. So what does your investing timeline look like? Are you guys looking at 5 years in the future, 10 years in the future, 15? Like, what does that kind of look like?
We have a 10-year horizon across all of our funds, which generally means that we have 5 years to invest and 5 years to harvest the investments. So given that timeline, we're usually looking in the ballpark of 5 to 8 years out. We also don't actively trade and are a pure venture fund in the sense that we're a very long-term partner to all of the projects that we invest in. So regardless of if you're a company financed via equity or a decentralized protocol financed via token, our view is going to be long only and with a pretty long investment period that we kind of target.
So if you had any advice for teams coming to pitch you, what would it be?
Yeah, I mean, I think above all, be yourself. Don't try to put on a facade or sugarcoat things to tell us what you think we might want to hear. I mean, the best conversations are, I think, are honest explorations of a topic or problem. Ultimately, we're trying to get a gauge for how the team is thinking and how that translates into plans and action. So to the extent that they can walk us through their decision-making process until now and what has been learned from that path, I think that's really useful. And for me personally, I like to spend most of the time talking about the problems that a team's trying to solve right now, because that gives me the most insight into how they'll deal with rapidly changing conditions in an industry that's really evolving very quickly.
So where do you want to be professionally in the next 5 years?
Yeah, that's a tough question. Whenever I try to speculate on things more than a few years out, I'm usually pretty wrong. And I like to avoid thinking that I'm on some linear path in life. Instead, I like to think of it more as kind of a tree that might branch off in any number of directions, depending on how I change as a person and how the world changes as well. You know, if I had to kind of look out right now, I think there are a few different places that I'd like to be in 5 years. I love my current job and I might still be an investor at Blockchain Capital. But if not, I think the most likely reason would be that I joined a portfolio company or am working on some sort of a crypto project of my own.
Love that. All right, let's jump into the closing questions. What is your single favorite NFT that you own?
It's probably a tie between two favorites. I picked up a Kenny Scharf NFT from a drop that that Nifty Gateway did a few weeks back. And I like that one. I think it's a cool piece of art. He's a New York artist that used to do stuff with Keith Haring, who's another artist that I really like. So I thought it was really cool that he was experimenting with NFTs, and I felt almost obligated as a New Yorker to pick one up. I'm trying to figure out what to do about display, to kind of your point earlier on where do you actually show these things off. Maybe I should actually hang it up in my other favorite NFT, which would be the parcel of land that I own in CryptoVoxels. I did a little bit of building, made a few iterations of it, but ended up making kind of a really basic and not very creative at all version of the Blockchain Capital office. And kind of like put up my email address and said, you know, send me your deck here or something like that. So I'll probably put the Kenny Scharf piece in there. And I think I need to go back and give it a bit of a home makeover as well. Maybe make it a little futuristic and possibly even move to a larger plot with a little bit more vertical optionality.
That's so cool. Wait, so you built an unofficial Blockchain Capital office in CryptoVoxels?
Yeah. I just kind of did it quickly, and it's really, I'm a little embarrassed of how uncool it is. So I need to do something about that when I have some time.
That's incredible. I could foresee a future where there's all sorts of different crypto companies, startups, and investors and whatnot that have, you know, presence in CryptoVoxels. And I see it as almost like a crypto social network. I think that'd be really cool to have, you know, investor meetings there or investor pitches and all types of different crypto activity within this realm.
Oh yeah, 100%. You know, actually after talking about the sort of the way that there's really been kind of like an artist district in CryptoVoxels, now I'm worried that I'm in the wrong spot and might need to move offices. So I could use some tips from you in terms of kind of location planning.
Don't worry. I'll tell you all the good spots. Don't worry.
Awesome. Appreciate it.
All right. What is something that you'd like to see happen or something that you think needs to happen to the crypto ecosystem?
Yeah, I'll start with the like to see. I would like to see good models for progressive security become standardized amongst crypto wallets and applications. And so by progressive security, I mean different levels of authentication, depending on how much value is being transacted. sending $5 to a decentralized application doesn't need the same level of security as sending $50,000. And I think progressive security is one of the key things that will make it easier to onboard people outside of crypto. We have a pretty abysmal conversion rate right now from top of the funnel, and people generally don't make it past the back up your seed phrase part. So I'd like to see that shift to a more dynamic, more accommodating model where you start off maybe in a custodial setting that looks more like Web 2 with a username and password, but slowly accumulate more levels of security as your value at risk rises. I think that'll be important to bringing in the next leg of users who may not be motivated by decentralization ideologically. And that kind of, I think, actually ties in pretty neatly to what I would say needs to happen to the crypto ecosystem, which is that I think crypto needs to find new ways to communicate its benefits in simpler terms for people. I think it's pretty difficult for newcomers to grasp why they should want to use a service that's decentralized over a centralized one, especially when you consider that most people are generally comfortable with centralized services that they use today. A lot of projects in the crypto also claim to be decentralized, but maintain a degree of control over the protocols, maybe for the time being. Maybe they're doing that progressively over time, which is fine. But I think that you run the risk of eroding trust if messaging around that isn't handled really carefully. And so my opinion is that it's good to be ideologically driven, but ultimately most consumers are not. And they care more about the tangible benefits of using a new service. You know, can I make money here? Can I do things that I can't do elsewhere? And decentralization is a really good pitch to developers. But as we transition towards onboarding the next leg of users, I think the value prop has to simplify and translate into some more tangible things for consumers.
Those are some really, really valid points. And I think that simplifying crypto is really, really important to bringing on, you know, the next million and eventually billion users. All right, so what are the main barriers to adoption in the crypto space?
Yeah, the big ones I think are usability and scalability right now, and probably usability first. I think usability is probably the biggest barrier right now, as there are technically ways to scale via layer two, or even just to minimize the amount that your application or service uses block space. Onboarding, I think, is a big part of this, and I think progressive security will help ease that pain. But other things like providing transaction assurances or better feedback for the user will help a lot as well. I think we have a pretty long way to go on that side, but a lot of progress has been made in the last few years, so I'm very encouraged. In terms of scalability, while there are approaches that are more conscious of using block space, none of those have really begun to become industry standards yet. There's a lot of stuff happening on chain today that doesn't need to. And we've seen fees rise recently, which prices out a ton of users and transactions. I think that's natural, and it makes only higher value transactions appropriate for the time being. But if we're going to be able to scale economic activity on blockchains 10, 100, 1,000 times, we're going to need very different ways of using the blockchain and probably different architectures for applications as well.
So will there be a viral event that causes mainstream adoption of crypto, or do you think that it'll just be a slow and gradual grind of adoption?
Yeah, I think on this, we can kind of extrapolate from the past a bit. The growth of crypto so far has really been driven by, you know, a series of viral events that manifest as bull markets, that each of which have sparked a lot of interest and investment from new consumers and companies. Crypto is, I think, extremely reflexive in that way, where rising prices catalyzes large increases in long-term infrastructure investments. And so this has helped finance exchanges, custodians, brokerages, payment providers, new protocols, new applications and services in crypto. And, you know, of course, prices come down after a crazy bull market, but those new infrastructure pieces and applications and services are generally here to stay, and the industry is permanently strengthened as a result. So you get this really strong positive feedback loop that repeats every few years, and I expect that to continue during the discovery phase, as I think most people in the world still have no idea what crypto is. So my guess is that it's going to be a series of viral events centered around bull markets, but you know, I'm sure there could be other things that I'm not anticipating at all, and maybe some of these are like the launch of something like Libra or or other large networks entering the space in some way.
All right, last question. Where do you see the world of crypto in 3 years?
Yeah, I mean, in 3 years, I think it's hard. It's tough to make predictions, but I think we'll see big companies from outside of crypto step in a pretty big way, possibly by acquiring or by partnering with crypto companies or by launching their own products. We've already gotten a bit of taste of this with Libra, and I think that's the tip of the iceberg. Libra lit a fire under a lot of corporates, and the difference this time around is that I think a lot of them have been doing their homework since 2017, maybe with a skeptical eye. But I think that it's going to be driven by a few things, but primarily a shift from crypto being viewed as a more esoteric, high-risk asset class to crypto being viewed as something that you have to service, because if you don't, you won't be competitive. I think that we'll see this with brokerage companies first and then maybe payments companies afterwards. But if you look at something like Robinhood, they've clearly benefited from adding crypto and have added a lot of users as a result, which has really strengthened their other products as well. And Square, I think, is starting to see the same thing. So I think we'll see more meaningful enterprise adoption, but adoption of public networks and crypto assets more so than permission chains, which is kind of where we've seen enterprise interest being the strongest in the past.
Awesome. All right, Alex. Well, this has been absolutely amazing. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. I loved hearing about your background and your views on the metaverse, and especially your kind of investment processes and thoughts at Blockchain Capital. But if people want to reach out to you and learn more about Blockchain Capital, where should they go and what should they do?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, first, thanks so much for having me on the podcast. This was a pleasure and a really interesting conversation. I think I learned a lot as well. So really, really happy to have been a part of it. For people that want to follow along, I'm on Twitter at underscore Alex Larson, and I spell my name with a K, so it's kind of funky. You might read the podcast notes instead. I'm on Medium as well at my first and last name, and you can also find me at blockchain.capital, where we have blogs and a number of other resources as well.
Awesome, Alex. Well, I can't wait to have you on again in a couple of months and give me an update on all things Blockchain Capital.
All right, great. Well, thanks so much.
Hey, everyone. Stay tuned for more episodes of the ZemaRed podcast and subscribe to the ZemaRed newsletter for more info on all things NFTs. Thanks so much for listening.